Well, thank you for coming today. We're going to go ahead and resume our study. Thanks to Frank for looking after things the last couple of weeks while I was away. What we're going to do this fall is resume our historical survey of Christianity through the course of the centuries. We're going to pick up in the Middle Ages during the first part of the fall. You can see on the table here, as my assistants are demonstrating for you, along with your class outline and notes, there is a little blue handout that has the schedule for the fall that'll tell you the topics that we're covering and some of the scriptures that we'll be reading, so you can use this to kind of get an idea of what we're going to talk about. We're going to start the class with something of an overview and a thematic introduction. We studied over the course of the summer the early church in the New Testament, kind of where it came from, how it ties in with the things we see in the Old Testament, how it fits together with the history of ancient Israel, and then we studied how the early church grew and some of the characteristics of the early church, some of the things that we can learn from their example and their experience. We also took a look then at how the early church started to change during the 2nd, 3rd, and 4th and 5th centuries AD, how the early church transformed from what you see in the scriptures, where it's more of an informal organization, more of a family, not an institution, not an establishment, to where by the time that we reach the Middle Ages, the church has become something much different, a very rigid hierarchy, very intolerant of diverging views or dissent, and very jealous of its own power and wealth. And so what we're going to do during the course of the fall is take up the theme of restoring the New Testament church, going back to the New Testament church. You could call it rediscovering the New Testament church. Through the centuries, there have always been believers who felt that the church should be what you see in the New Testament, regardless of what the situation was like around them, no matter what they were told by religious authorities, no matter what they were told by secular authorities. There have always been people who felt, you know, it's just more important to do things the way we read it in God's Word. We have a fellowship that we call the Churches of Christ, or sometimes just the Church of Christ, that refers in at least to some degree to a fellowship that was started a couple hundred years ago in our nation. This is really historically only one of many attempts that people have made through the centuries. And so what we want to learn a little bit about this fall is not just our own fellowship and where it came from, which will be part of our study, but also to take a look at all the people through the centuries who have looked at the religious establishment, these big, wealthy, politically powerful churches, and said, there's got to be a better way. There's been a lot of people through the ages who saw that and who wanted the same things that, at least to some degree, we believe in. And so we're going to hope that we can learn a lot of things from that. Today what we're going to do is we're going to read some scriptures from Jeremiah about seeking the ancient paths. We're going to review some things from Acts chapter 2. These will be more familiar, just to kind of set a foundation to remind us of some of the basics of the gospel. And then we're going to do a little historical survey just to kind of help you see how some things fit together that we'll be looking at in more depth and detail in the coming weeks. Don is going to go ahead and lead us in a short time of prayer, and then we'll get started. Amen. All right. Thanks very much. Let's start off in Jeremiah. I'm going to read a couple of passages here in the book of Jeremiah, and this will kind of give us a your electronic gadget to go out on you this morning or something. You need to get one of the little extra stock there. When I open up my Bible, it's always ready. I don't have to get new batteries or anything like that for it. And when I turn on the chalkboard, it's always ready too. I don't need to worry about any mechanical malfunctions. Jeremiah chapter 6, and there'll be another one over in Jeremiah chapter 18. Jen, could you read for us Jeremiah 6, just verse 16, and then Dot, could you read right afterwards, we'll read these together, Jeremiah 18, verses 14 to 15. And then Lloyd, if you wouldn't mind, could you cue up Matthew 11, 28 to 30? We'll look at that in a little bit, so just have that ready to go in a few minutes. But let's read the Jeremiah ones together.
Thus says the Lord, stand by the road and look, and ask for the ancient paths, where the good way is, and walk in it, and find rest in your souls. But they said, we will not walk in it. Does the snow of Lebanon ever vanish from its rocky slopes? Do its cool waters from distant sources ever cease to flow? Yet my people have forgotten me. They burn incense to worthless idols, which make them stumble in their ways and in their ways.
Very good. Thank you very much. I didn't let you finish, did I? I'm sorry. I'm used to dealing with Norma that I gotta cut her short here. Please continue, Dot. I'm sorry.
They make them walk in by paths and on the roads not built up.
Thank you very much. That was worth making sure that we got that one in there. What's the common theme? What's the common phrase that you hear in those two scriptures in Jeremiah? You can just go ahead, peek at the outline or peek at the chalkboard if you wish. He talks about the ancient paths. He says, ask for the ancient paths, and then in Jeremiah 16. And then in chapter 18, he talks about the ancient paths that they have forgotten. They aren't walking in the ancient paths. Now, the interesting thing about that is that when was Jeremiah written? What do we really how do we usually refer to the time period when Jeremiah was alive? It's ancient, isn't it? So Jeremiah was actually talking about something that in his lifetime, 600 years before Jesus, was already ancient, was already long past and long forgotten. And the first very basic point is that even in ancient times, people had done what? They'd forgotten the ancient past. Even in ancient times, people already needed to get back on there. So when you look at the world today and become concerned or disturbed by the things you see, it's nothing new. There isn't anything new under the sun. There's always been a need for God's people constantly to be called back to an older and simpler way, to the way that God made it at the beginning, where people sought God for His own sake, where people didn't get bogged down in rules or traditions or rituals. That's what the specific problem was in Jeremiah's lifetime. He has a famous sermon elsewhere in Jeremiah called the Temple Sermon, where he mocks people for their worship of the temple instead of worshiping God, for their enthusiasm in offering sacrifice after sacrifice and then going out and living lives of materialism and violence. And it's the same problem that you encounter in different variations throughout history. Humans always like to have their own little compact religion and feel as if that justifies them, and then as soon as they've checked the last item off the list, they're free to go out and do whatever they want. This was the problem in Jeremiah's lifetime also. You know, it's kind of like a stock feature of religious speakers to bemoan the deplorable state of the world today. And you can see things like this in so many different contexts. I read a speech by a senator once where he said, oh, the times we live in. Oh, the morals that people have today. Children and the things that they do today would have been unheard of in former times. Well, do you know who that senator was? Cicero, the Roman senator, writing 50 years before Jesus. It wasn't anything new. I read an essay by a British historian who said, In the time of King Edwin, you could push a baby carriage from one end of England to the other without being molested or troubled. But now you can't even walk down the street without being assailed by thugs. Do you know when that was written? The 8th century. Not the 18th century, the 8th century. He was already bemoaning the state of modern Britain in the 700s of how it wasn't like it was back when Edwin was king. It's an old, old feeling. And it's true as long as you understand that the real implications is not to bemoan the state of our world, but to realize that it's human nature to need to be reminded. Let's go back to the ancient past, when it was simpler, when it wasn't bogged down with human religion and it was just us seeking God. Back in Jeremiah 6, what does he promise you if you walk in the ancient paths? Ask for the ancient paths and walk in them, and what you will find what? You'll find rest for your souls. Now that's a promise, and it's also an interesting thing for us to think is. It says if you ask where the good way is and walk in it, you'll find rest for your souls. Now, it's a nice promise, but it also helps to clarify what these ancient paths are. Because he's saying, if you found them, how will you know it? Because you'll find rest for your soul. You're not going to be restless. You're not going to be competing with other people. You're not going to be demanding that other people recognize, hey, look, I found the ancient paths over here. What's wrong with you? I found them over here. You're not going to use that as a motivation to get into conflict or to become prideful. It's going to give you rest for your souls. This is where another scripture comes in. This phrase, rest for your souls, is that familiar from someplace else? Yeah. You can cheat. It's right here. It's in Matthew 11. Lloyd, go ahead. Now that you, I know you had that ready. Go ahead. 28 to 30.
Come to me, all you who are weary and burdened, and I will give you rest. Take my yoke upon you and learn from me, for I am gentle and humble in heart, and you will find rest for your souls. For my yoke is easy and my burden is light.
It's an interesting parallel because Jesus and Jeremiah say the same thing. Jeremiah says, if you find the ancient paths, you'll find rest for your souls. Not necessarily rest for your bodies, not necessarily conviction for your brain, but rest for your souls. And Jesus says this exactly the same thing. You're weary, you're burdened, you come to me and you'll find rest for your souls. Now the people who follow Jesus, they often lived rather rigorous lifestyles, and they often were confused about things that he was teaching them, but one thing they always had was rest for their souls. They found the resting place for their soul, where they could forget about the anxiety, the worry about their purpose in life, where they knew they were accepted. And that's what the ancient paths do. You see, it's one of the sad ironies about what I mockingly talked about, how everyone bemoans the state of the world today and thinks we should get back to a simpler time. They always do that in such a contentious way. But Jeremiah says, look, if we're walking in the ancient paths, that's not what it's going to do for us. It's not going to make us angry or resentful about people who aren't doing it. It's going to give us rest. We're not going to feel that anxious, insecure need to point out to other people what they're doing wrong. Hey, look, I'm walking in the ancient paths. Look, you're doing it wrong over there. That's not what it does. It gives you rest for your soul. It relieves you of that constant strain of having to compete with other people, of having to argue with other people, of having to judge other people, of having to evaluate other people, of having to evaluate and judge yourself. When you find the ancient paths, you're the oldest way of seeking God, all the way back to when God first created people, is what did God want them to do? Is just be with them. Because he'd created them and he loved them. And that's what Jesus is saying in Matthew 11. He said, just come to me. Now take my, what? Take my yoke. In other words, let yourself be guided by me. Give up your own self-will and your own insistence on doing it your own way. And that ties back in with what Jeremiah says in chapter 18, because he tells us what the problem is, why these people are not walking in the ancient paths. It's not because they're hard to find. Yeah, this is what his metaphor in verse 14. Does the snow of Lebanon ever vanish from its rocky slopes? Well, no. You look at the mountains of Lebanon, you look at the Rocky Mountains, for that matter. There's always snow up there, isn't there? He says, does the cool water from distant sources ever cease to flow? Well, no. Now, he's not really talking about nature. He's saying, am I ever absent? Am I ever gone? Do I ever turn away anyone that comes to me? No. God's always there. God's always just waiting. And he describes the problem, and Jeremiah says that the problem is not that they don't know where the ancient paths are. It's not that they're not good enough to walk in them. It's just that they're just too stubborn to walk in them. They insist on burning incense to their own idols. Finding the ancient paths is not a matter of deep study and calculation and finding some secret knowledge that other people don't have. It's a simple matter of humility. Simple matter of asking, and God says, the ancient path is right here. Jesus says, come to me. And seeing that and accepting it in humility. And so, connecting it in with a little historical study, when you talk about seeking the ancient paths, restoring the New Testament church, returning to the New Testament church, the test of whether we've done that is not, can we prove that we're doing everything right? It's, did we find rest for our souls? When we compare our fellowship to others and our feeling is, well, we're doing it right and those people over there need to be straightened out, it's a tip-off. We're not in the ancient paths yet. Because the ancient paths brings you rest for your soul. It doesn't make you feel compelled that you've got to go out and push your little theories and factoids on other people. It makes you feel, hey, I've found God. Oh, this is great. I'm so lucky. And if I ever get a chance by grace, I'll try to calm other people's hearts and souls the way that mine has been calmed. And what Jeremiah is telling us is that the problem is people insist on making their own paths. They insist on walking on roads that aren't really roads at all. And this is exactly what the people of Jeremiah's day were doing. They were worshiping the temple. They were worshiping the religious leaders. They were worshiping their nation. They were coming up with all kind of rituals and festivals and everything. And then they were saying, hey, we're cool. We're great. And they were, unfortunately, living the rest of their lives did not show that at all. They were materialistic. They were violent. They were engaged in wars. They were engaged in constant conflicts because religion is not the ancient path. God is the ancient path. God himself is the ancient path. Human religion doesn't give us rest for our souls. Idols of any kind don't give you rest for your souls. When we feel this compulsion that we've got to argue with people and straighten them out and tell them what's wrong, it should be a tip-off to us. Hey, we don't have rest for our souls. We haven't found the thing that God really wants to give us. You remember in Galatians, remember what Paul said to the Galatians? He said, you guys have accepted a gospel that's not really a gospel at all. Now, do you know what he meant by that? You guys believe the wrong thing. It's false. You guys need to study the right book. Well, what's the literal meaning of gospel? Good news. He says, you guys have a gospel that isn't good news. Because what did it do to them? What did it do to the Galatians when they heard this other gospel? It made them feel, oh, we got to obey all these laws. We got to get circumcised. We got to make these sacrifices. Now, oh, we didn't know this. That goof Paul didn't tell us about this. He just told us that our sins were going to be forgiven. Oh, thank you for telling us about all these laws and rules that we've got to follow now. Oh, and you guys over there, you need to follow them too. You need to follow all these laws too. And I know Paul forgot, but these brilliant teachers have now taught us we need to obey all these rules now. That's why it was not the gospel. Because it wasn't good news. The gospel is good news. The gospel means that you find rest for your souls. And walking in roads that aren't roads, it's so much human nature. It's such a part of who we are. And we tend, in this concept of returning to the Bible, returning to the New Testament church, we tend to be very selective about things. We tend to feel, well, we've recreated New Testament Christianity here. This is exactly the way it was. Those people over there, they're goofing it up, but we got it right. You know, we don't use the stuff that they, you know, they disobey the rule about not using organs, and they disobey the rule about calling your preacher a father and stuff like that. They disobey that stuff. We obey the rules. You know, we obey Romans 17, where it says your preacher will use a microphone and wear a suit. We obey those rules. We don't disobey the rules out there that says you don't have to have popes and cardinals and everything like that. We obey the rules that say you have class at 9:30 and worship at 10:30. We obey all these rules. And when we look here, we'll look over at Acts chapter 2. This very familiar chapter. But the point that he's saying is that finding the ancient roads, as Jesus himself said, you'll know it by the fruit it produces. And we tend to equate fruit, being rationalistic Americans, we tend to equate fruit with tangible results. But the scripture describes fruit of the Spirit in Galatians 5 as what? Love and joy and peace and patience and kindness and goodness and gentleness and self-control. That's how you know if you're in the ancient paths. Does it bring you peace, and does it make you gentle and patient and gracious to other people? That's how you know if you're in the ancient paths. That's how you know if you found them. And here, I'll cater to my engineering friends here. If you can only get one thing out of today's class, let it be this. If you can only get one thing, I'll write it up on the board. If you can only get one thing, when we talk about restoring the New Testament church, it's more about restoring the perspectives and the priorities of the early Christians than trying to imitate their behavior or trying to copy their beliefs. It's more about understanding what they understood, that life is about grace, life is about faith, life is about love. That's what it really means to restore New Testament Christianity. Not restoring a certain format of worship or a certain set of doctrines that somebody seems to have forgotten about. It's about restoring that attitude of living by grace, of living in the shadow of the cross and the light of the empty tomb. Living around those things and orienting what you believe and think around the cross and the empty tomb instead of around human religion and human reason and human activity. When we talk about restoring the New Testament church, that's what's most important, because that's what the world is missing. That's what all these religious groups out there, that's what their real problem is. It's not that they're breaking some rules, because we're breaking some rules too. It's not that they haven't checked the right item off their list, because there's a lot of stuff unchecked on our little list too. It's not that they fail to understand some important doctrines, because we fail to understand some important doctrines. It's that they, like too often we do, have turned religion into a program, into an institution, into a package that we need to subscribe to and believe and obey, instead of the real ancient paths, which gets back to just accepting God's grace and accepting the fact that we can never deserve to have a relationship with our Creator, and yet He wants it. He wants us to know Him, and He forgives us of everything. Let's do a little reading in Acts chapter 2. I hope it's okay. I'm not going to read verse 38. I assume you know it. It's a good verse. It's an excellent verse. But I'm going to read some other things just to remind you that there's a context that goes with verse 38 that's just important. Picking up here in Acts chapter 2, in verse, let's see, let's just read 22 to 24. Ben, if you could take care of that for us. And then Frank, if you could go with 42 to 47.
They devoted themselves to the apostles' teaching and to the fellowship, the breaking of bread, and to prayer. Everyone was filled with awe, and many wonders and miraculous signs were done by the apostles. All the believers were together and had everything in common, selling their possessions and goods they gave to anyone as he had need. Every day they continued to meet together in the temple courts. They broke bread in their homes, ate together with glad and sincere hearts, praising God and enjoying the favor of all the people. And the Lord added to the number daily those who were being saved.
Well, thanks very much. And I assume you're familiar with the general context of this. This is some excerpts taken from a obviously a very important day in the history of Christianity. In Peter's lesson, he reminds them, and then much of the rest of his lesson is emphasizing these same things. He reminds them of Jesus. His lesson, which produced those first 3,000 baptisms, focused on Jesus. It just focused on who Jesus was and what he did. It didn't focus on all the doctrines that they would need to learn. It didn't focus on all the things they would be required to do. He didn't outline for them, now, okay, Sunday morning, Sunday night, Wednesday night, small group, this is what it's all about. Didn't have anything in there. And if you read through the book of Acts, all the other sermons that they give, none of that in there either. It was all about Jesus, his life, who he was, his death on the cross, and the resurrection that proved the truth of the other things that he stood for. And this is what the ancient paths are, proclaiming Jesus, who he was, that he died on a cross for our sins, that he raised and proved that he was the Son of God and offered us the promise of a new life too. These are the ancient paths, just sticking with that. And see, that is really so rare in the religious world. That is so rare for people just to tell you the gospel and to do what Peter did. Okay, you ready to repent and be baptized and follow Jesus without any extra human conditions and without any extra human teachings attached to it. Acts 2:38 is a wonderful verse. You repent, you get baptized into Christ, and all of a sudden your sins are forgiven for nothing. And oh, as just a tiny little bonus, the Spirit of God will live in your heart the rest of your life. It's incredible. And Peter so accurately describes it. He doesn't say this command is for you and your children. He says what? Promise. This promise is for you and your children. It's a promise. And if we understand it as a promise, it means so much more. Now, it's perfectly acceptable to be baptized into Christ because you knew it, God told you how to do it, and you didn't think you had any choice. That's perfectly acceptable. It's just that you're missing something if that's all it is to you. It's a wonderful promise. And it's based not on the fact that it's such a meritorious thing to let someone dunk you in a pool of water. You know, that's not a demonstration of wonderful moral character that you stand there and let someone dunk you underwater. It's simply a symbolic act to join us into Christ in an important symbolic way. It's still, salvation is still free. It still comes absolutely by grace. And you see this in this description of the early Christians, how they lived in grace, how they didn't consider their possessions their own. They didn't consider their time their own. They were so caring and loving towards each other, and they were so gracious towards everybody else. And this very description here teaches us, this is the connection between the ancient paths and when we found them, and when we walk in them, that's what you do. You live in grace. You live in peace. You live in charity and love towards other people. And it's, even in this passage, it should be a little reminder to us, it's not about imitating all the outward things. Because you look in this passage, and there's some big things that we who talk so much about how we obey all the commands in the Bible and we reproach everybody else for not obeying them, there's some big ones in there that we're not doing. Nobody that I know has sold all their possessions and goods and given it to other people in there. You see, that's because this was right after these people who were visiting from all the other parts of the empire had come to Jerusalem and they needed to be, there was a special circle. Oh, I see. You know something? That's what everybody does. That's what everybody does. We're not unique in that. Oh, yeah, we follow all the teachings except for the ones that really don't apply to our time and place. Everybody does that. The Catholics do that. The Baptists do that. The Methodists do it. They all say, look, we do it the way it says in the Bible. Yeah, but you're not doing this the way it says in the Bible. Oh, well, that's because there's a very good reason not to do that one. See, our guys studied it out. Everybody's like that. See, it's okay that we're like that. It's all right that we're like that because it's not about imitating all the outward things. It's about returning to the ancient paths of grace and charity and humility. That's what it's about. It's not about having to imitate all the little things we do. Because nobody does that. Nobody makes any real attempt to do that. We all pick the things that sound easy to us. Okay, yeah, we can do without any popes or stuff like that. We can live without that. We can live without all the rituals and that. Sure. We can't live without air conditioning, though. We can't live without having a nice building to come to. We're not going to go down in caves like the early Christians did. Everybody does that, and it's perfectly okay as long as we realize we're not any different from anybody else. We haven't come any closer to recreating the exact physical conditions of the early church than anybody else has. And it's not important to do that. What's important is to return to the absolute dependence on grace, the absolute trust in God, the absolute compassion and grace towards others that the early Christians showed. That's what was so different about them, that they didn't need all this other stuff, not because they were afraid they'd break a rule, but because they simply didn't need it. They didn't need to have all these church hierarchies because they all spent time with God and let God teach them. They didn't need a lot of fancy stuff in their church because they knew they had greater and more lasting treasure. And that's the thing that you learn if you walk in the ancient paths. You don't worry so much about breaking rules because you don't need so many rules all of a sudden. You're motivated by much stronger things. The living, caring body in the New Testament, that's always what God has told us is the indication that we're living in grace. We're not unique from other fellowships because we're doing 99% of the stuff right and they're only doing 45% of the stuff right. It doesn't matter what percent of the stuff right is. Now, if you were to measure some kind of statistical thing, I would imagine that we're a little closer in all the external things than most other groups are. But it doesn't really matter because you're still saved by grace. If you're only doing 99% of it, you still need grace, don't you? You're still falling short of perfection. And that's okay. And it's okay. It's okay that nobody's doing it exactly right. We're not any different from anybody else in that respect. You know, there's an old movie that I remember back in the 60s called Grand Prix. It was about these race car drivers competing for the championship. And before those of you who like these explosion movies get excited, there are very few crashes, only a couple. It's really more about the psychological portrait of these drivers and what compels them to have such a dangerous way of making a living. Well, the main character is this American who's gone over to Europe to try to race the Grand Prix cars, and he's having trouble being accepted. He's kind of stubborn and self-willed, and so he gets kicked off his team by the one guy who owned his car. So he's going around trying to find another guy who'll give him a chance. He's a brilliant driver, real talented, but he's real stubborn. And so he goes to the Ferrari plant in Italy to ask him to join him, let him join their team. And the boss talks to him and says, "Look, you're a great driver, but you're just not worth the risk. I've got good drivers. Maybe they're not as talented as you, but they'll do what I tell them to do." And so this American driver says, "Yes, but you got to hire me because I want to be the champion." And the Ferrari boss just looks at him and said, "Everybody wants to be the champion. There is no distinction in that. Everybody wants to be the ones that's doing it all right. Everybody wants that. There's no distinction in that. There's no distinction between us and everybody else if we just say we're the ones who are doing it all right. Everybody thinks that. Maybe we're 90% right and they're 20% right, but it doesn't matter. Because what the world really needs is not improved doctrines or methods. It's a lot more grace, a lot more love, a lot more faith, a lot more true reliance on God and less reliance on human brilliance and human wisdom." Little historical overview. With that in mind, I want to give you a little preview of what we're going to talk about, just to kind of help you see before we get rolling on all the history again, how it fits together. And I guess it'll also give you a little tip off some of these topics that we're going to talk about. You can find out which ones sound especially boring and know which classes to skip. We're going to start with the Middle Ages, which is where we left off. Now, the Middle Ages, to historians, it usually is defined as being roughly 500 to about 1500 AD. It's very arbitrary. The fall of Rome, the fall of the Roman Empire dates from the late 400s. Historians usually say that kind of brought in the Middle Ages because it kind of destabilized so much of the world and brought so many changes in the daily lives of people and in learning and everything like that. It's kind of an arbitrary term in some ways, but in other ways it's actually pretty significant. The Middle Ages usually are considered to end about 1500 because of two things. In the 1450s, the invention of the movable printing press had a dramatic impact on a lot of things in the world, but in particular it had a dramatic impact on religious learning. And then in the 1490s, the first European explorations of the New World brought in a lot of new dynamics. The European countries began to compete with each other for the wealth of the New World, which brought in a lot of new factors and dynamics that weren't part of the medieval world. Now note that I said it's when the Europeans explored the New World. They didn't discover it because it was already here. And a lot of people already knew it was here. But they did explore it, and it did change the dynamics of global politics and economics in a lot of different ways. Well, during the Middle Ages, we have what we call the two established churches. And a kind of a, I suppose it's somewhat technical, talk of an established church. You understand what that means? An established church doesn't just mean it's been there for a while. It means a church that's propped up by civil governments. An established church is a church that's been acknowledged by the civil government as this is the right church. This is the one you're supposed to belong to. Can be sometimes be the only legal church, as in the late Roman Empire. Can be the church that gets all the money and the support and puts it a big advantage, as in a lot of countries still today, for that matter. There are two established churches in the Middle Ages. In the West, which means Western Europe and Northern Africa, you had the Roman Catholic Church. And in the East, which is Eastern Europe and Western Asia, you had the Orthodox Church. These are the two big established churches through the Middle Ages. And in medieval history, religion played an integral role in the entire history of the world. It's sometimes been called the Age of Faith by people who don't know any better, because it really had nothing to do with faith, it had to do with religion. You had the Catholic Church insisting that it was the only legitimate church, and therefore it must be doing everything right. And you had the Orthodox Church insisting that it was doing everything right, and therefore it had to be the only legitimate church. And they fought with each other, and they suppressed unbelief, and they suppressed their enemies throughout the Middle Ages. They're also very powerful. You can't talk about medieval history without talking about the influence of these churches. Now, there were some positive things about what these churches did too, especially in the West. The Catholic Church was the one point of lasting stability and constancy for much of the Middle Ages. Middle Ages were a very chaotic time in Europe especially. And the Catholic Church, one of the reasons why everyone held it in such high esteem and essentially worshipped it, is because it was really the only major institution that provided any kind of real stability or confidence. Well, it's kind of a mixed legacy, though. These churches, they certainly gave people a sense of stability. They practiced certainly what we would consider to be very good examples of morality and standards of behavior. They certainly set an example, both of them, in charitable works and looking after the poor and that. They also set a very negative example. They were also eagerly promoted. Persecution, prejudice, violence, started wars, used religion as a justification for a lot of horrible things. Very mixed legacy. And when you study the Middle Ages, it's kind of a testing ground for some of the goofy things that people believe today about the church and the government and how they should interact. Because you see how things that seem at first to be good, you're trying to get people to do the right thing, can pretty quickly descend into something pretty ugly when you start to try to force people to do things that you want them to do. You look at the Crusades, the Inquisition, some of the prejudice against Jews, the horrible oppression of women throughout the Middle Ages. You see a lot of the ways that big institutionalized churches can just turn from doing some good things and promoting a good example to being extremely oppressive and extremely negative. So the legacy of these churches is very mixed. Well, the thing that we're at least in part interested in through the Middle Ages is that there were a lot of people all through the Middle Ages who wanted something a little different, something a little better. You know, again, when we come to the time later in the fall when we study about how our particular fellowship, the Churches of Christ, began, it's kind of like one of those charts you see in science textbooks about the history of the geological world. You know, if you ever see one of those graphs of geological time, how you know, they have a circle that's supposed to represent the age of the universe, and most of the circle is before the earth even began. And then there's like a little slice of it of the time of prehistoric animals and dinosaurs and everything. And then there's a little ice age in there. And then you get a little teeny sliver at the very end that this is where human beings came on the earth. Very tiny sliver of geological time. Same thing is very true in church history. Is our fellowship, what we call the Churches of Christ, cannot be studied in isolation. It's a product of its own time and place, which in turn was a product of hundreds of years of history, which was a product of hundreds of years of people trying things and doing things, sometimes very similar to what we are trying to do, to what we want to do. The concept of getting back to the Bible, the concept of returning to the New Testament, has been called by many things. I'm using the word restore or restoration basically for historical reasons. You don't have to use it if you don't like it. There's nothing magical about it. There's nothing special about it. If you read histories written by members of the Churches of Christ or our brother and sister fellowships, the Christian Church and the Disciples of Christ, who are very closely related to our fellowship, they, historians of those groups, use the words Restoration Fellowship. That's what they call us. It's just a term, so if you like it, terrific. If you don't, you're welcome to use something else. You don't have to call it Restoring New Testament Christianity if you don't like it. You can call it Returning to New Testament Christianity, or Rediscovering New Testament Christianity, or Readopting New Testament Christianity. You don't even have to call it New Testament Christianity if you don't like it. You can call it Ancient Christianity, or Early Christianity, or Christianity Classic, or whatever you like. You can build your own marketing group. I don't care. It's fine. So don't fuss at me for using the word restoration, because I don't think it's anything magical either. It just makes it easy if you're used to it to read histories, if you ever do it, which I know you'll all do in your spare time. But that's why I'm going to use the word. You use your own word, whatever you like, to mean this concept of trying to pull away from the baggage of human tradition and ritual and trying to just see what Christianity is like in the Scriptures. Whatever term you like is fine. Historians of our fellowship use the word restoration for that. And it's a good enough word for me. I'll try to vary it up a little bit just for any of you who are allergic to particular words, because I do understand that. I can be a fuss budget too about stuff like that. But during the Middle Ages, there were a lot of fellowships that tried to do this. They looked a lot different from ours. And one of the things that you sometimes will see is well-meaning historians of our fellowship will say, well, this group tried to return the New Testament Christianity, but that's what they did wrong. And this group over here, they did the same thing, but that's what they did wrong too. So none of them really are right. But that's not the point. The point is that, again, what's most important is the concept of returning to the cross, returning to the empty tomb. That's the concept thing, putting that at the center of Christianity instead of the human ritual and the human doctrine, wherever you got it and however you chose to justify it. And there were a lot of groups throughout the Middle Ages that wanted to do that. And there are brothers and sisters, even though they looked a lot different from us, even though they taught some stuff that we think would be pretty wacky, and even though all of them ultimately failed to last throughout the Middle Ages. They failed to last largely because these two churches were awfully powerful and they were very good at stamping out people who didn't do things the way that they thought they did. In the West, and we'll talk about these in a future lesson, in the West, for example, you had a group called the Cathars, who in the High Middle Ages, sometimes called the Albigenses, this was a very influential group for a good while. They were based on the idea of, very simple, we want to return to the New Testament. We don't want all this religious hierarchy and political involvement and wars and violence. We just want to get back to what's in the New Testament. There's a man named Peter Waldo, who we'll talk about, who started a group called the Waldenses, who was another ancient medieval reformer. Again, believed in trying to just focus on the cross. What do we learn from that? What does that tell us? Let's call into question some of these things that we just get from human tradition or ritual. You had just an example group. There's a group called the Pauperes Lombardi, the Lombardian paupers, that believed in a return to basically communism, because they saw in the New Testament something that we have a great many of reasons to explain why we don't do it. They saw that the early Christians were very anti-materialistic, and they made that the centerpiece of their return to the New Testament. In the East, out of the Orthodox Church came some restoration or return to the Bible movements of their own. A group called the Politians. I happen to know this is a particular favorite of Frank Chappell. Frank, in fact, asked me if I was going to be sure to cover these, because he's rather fond of them, so we will make sure to cover them. Another well-known group called the Bogomils, which is interesting because Bogomil was actually the guy's name that started it, but Bogomil in the Slavic languages means beloved of God, so it's actually kind of an ironic name. All these groups were for a time very influential, and I believe they've all left us some valuable lessons. All of them did some things that if we have a fussy mentality, we would all reject them. But if we have a mentality of understanding that return to New Testament Christianity is more about the perspective of the cross, then we would really appreciate what they were trying to do, regardless of some of their wackier teachings and wackier beliefs. Now, all of these things through the Middle Ages all of them eventually, all of those particular groups died out. There are no direct descendants of these today. And yet, all of them kind of kept alive this idea that you don't have to conceive of Christianity in terms of these massive, monolithic, powerful, wealthy church leaders who boss everybody else around. And you probably know that in the early 1500s, there was what we call the Reformation, the Protestant Reformation. And it's only because the Lutherans and the Calvinists adopted the word Reformations, that's one of the reasons why historians of the Churches of Christ don't use it. That's why they use Restoration instead. It's perfectly a good word in itself, too. It's just that historically it's gotten tangled up with some things that we think are wrong because they didn't do it our way. Well, there again, you can learn a lot from these people. The Reformation era is a very significant period in history in many ways, not just religiously. But I think it's well worth the time studying because Martin Luther and John Calvin and a lot of other people of that era, they started exactly the same place where we like to say we start. Hey, we don't have to have these big, wealthy, powerful people telling everyone else what to believe and telling you what to do all the time. We can have our own relationship with God. And there were a lot of roots of the Reformation era in the medieval times. One of the guys that we'll talk about is John Wycliffe, because Wycliffe, in the late Middle Ages, was one of the forerunners of Luther. And he also is very significant in the history of Bible translation. Wycliffe was one of the first people to try to get the Bible back into the hands of the average person. Because both of these churches throughout the Middle Ages very rigorously prevented people as much as they could from studying the scriptures on their own. They controlled the scriptures by making sure that scriptures were only available in Latin, so that if you wanted to study the Bible, you had to learn Latin first. Where were you going to learn Latin? From the church. While you were learning it, they would make sure to teach you how to use it, so that by the time you got around to reading the scriptures, you didn't make any mistakes by interpreting it yourself. Well, Wycliffe was very important in trying to counter that. Another man named Jan Hus, a Bohemian religious reformer who was a direct forerunner of Martin Luther, is also a medieval root of the Reformation area. The Protestant Reformation, you're probably most familiar with Martin Luther, but it also was the time when some of today's most powerful and influential churches began. You know that the Lutheran Church began in the Reformation. Also, the Calvinist Church, or what is often called the Reformed Churches, began at that same time period. It's really separate from Martin Luther. It was really a separate movement altogether. The Reformed Churches became known in Scotland as the Presbyterian Church, and this is probably more familiar to many Americans. Reformed and Presbyterian really is the same body, the same fellowship, so this is another of today's groups that goes back to the same era. In Great Britain, you had the Anglican Church started at the same time, King Henry VIII. Fascinating character whom we'll talk about a little bit. In America, the Anglican Church became known as Episcopal Church. So Episcopal Church is yet another church that goes back to this time. Now these churches, they started exactly the place where we like to say we start. Let's get back to the Bible. Let's get back to New Testament Christianity. Well, they all had their own histories. They all got to the point of feeling pretty good about what they had done and feeling pretty certain that they had done the job. And as soon as they got feeling that way, they looked around and they saw the other ones not doing it the same way. And they started having a lot of persecution of each other in England, in Germany, in France, all throughout Europe and other nations. These people started oppressing and persecuting people who didn't agree with them. The Catholics, not to be outdone, stepped up their persecution of people who belonged to these groups. And it led to a series of horrifying persecutions and wars and massive violence, culminating in 1618 in what's called the 30 Years' War, 1618 to 1648. 30 years, the entire continent of Europe was inflamed by war. In our own time, we hear and learn about World War I and World War II because they were so horrible. But they only lasted a few years. For 30 years, because of these religious differences, all the countries of Europe slaughtered each other and destroyed each other's nations and killed thousands and thousands of people because they were in the wrong religion. And at the end of the 30 Years' War, this incredible reaction set in. Historians call it the Age of Reason. And it can be dated very exactly from 1648 in the end of the 30 Years' War to 1789. The Age of Reason saw an incredible backlash against religion. Christianity and Islam, of course, Islam has its own history during the Middle Ages of doing some of the same things. Islam offers a mixed legacy of its own. Islam, through much of the Middle Ages, was one of the leading promoters of learning and science, even more so than Christianity. But Islam also added its own legacy of persecution and slaughter and violence. Well, in the Age of Reason, there's this incredible backlash. The cool thing to do, the thing that all the influential people did during the Age of Reason, was to reject religion altogether. Human reason can solve all these problems. Science can solve all these problems, not religion. See, it's nothing new. Well, why did the Age of Reason end in exactly 1789? Because the French Revolution, the French were the leading proponents of this Age of Reason. We can solve everything by human reason. It's all you need. And what did it lead to? It led to the French slaughtering each other and chopping each other's heads off thousands at a time and going around starting wars and trying to conquer the rest of the world because they were offended that everyone else couldn't see how reasonable they were. And that kind of ended the Age of Reason because it kind of showed that this concept of human reason being a god was just as bankrupt and just as silly as making religion your god. Well, a lot of new churches started in the Age of Reason because not everybody rejected religion. A lot of people looked at this Reformation era and the 30 Years' War and learned something different. They learned that, hey, it's not, religion isn't the problem. Christianity isn't the problem. It's human nature that's the problem. So we just need to start over again. And during the Age of Reason, you have a lot of new churches. The Baptists started in the Age of Reason. The Methodists started in the Age of Reason. Both of these groups, again, started with that same concept of, hey, let's get back to the Bible. Let's get back to the early church. That's exactly where they started. Well, in early America, which is where our particular fellowship comes in, you had an abundance of these fellowships. One of the peculiarities of America being kind of a backwards place in a lot of ways is you had a lot of small groups, a lot of small what we would call, again, restoration or reformation or return groups springing up. And amongst those groups, there were several of them, and it really is a unique aspect of the history of the Churches of Christ. One of the things different about the early history of the Churches of Christ is that there were several groups that had different concepts of what it meant to return to the New Testament, but they recognized in each other a common goal, and they actually came together instead of splitting up. Now, they've more than made up for it since. You know, it is really a great story how in the early 1800s, there's a guy called Barton Stone who founded the Christian Church. There was a father and son, the Campbells, who started the Disciples of Christ. And there were several smaller groups that we'll talk about. They all came together and formed what they called, for a time, the Churches of Christ. It really is a nice story because they really were able to work through a lot of different perspectives and see some common ground. And as I said, the Church of Christ have more than made up for it since then by dividing every which way. But there's some things that you can really learn from what they did to start that story. Well, after talking about uniting the threads, of course, the 19th century, the 20th century, our fellowship, our church, the Church of Christ, like any other church, is inextricably tied up with the history of its own time and place, much more than we like to admit it. And so that's what we're going to talk about in the little last part of our study. The church and the nation, their growing pains, successes, the failures, we'll focus on that. A little bit of trivia. There's a very famous novelist known for very serious novels who once wrote a story about a talking horse. The horse's name was not Mr. Ed, it was Strider. Was it Herman Melville? Was it Emily Bronte? Was it Charlotte Bronte? Little bonus trivia. Which Bronte wrote Wuthering Heights and which one wrote Jane Eyre? You have to go home to research that one. Put a little class in your day there. Was it Leo Tolstoy? Or was it Jane Austen? Well, it was in fact Leo Tolstoy, who wrote very, very serious novels, massive, hundreds of pages long. But he once wrote a short story about an old wise stallion named Strider, who as he was nearing his death, he called together all the other animals to talk about the world and to exhort them to accept the world for what it is and to just help each other and not fight against the way the world is. And in particular, he told them a lot of things about human beings. and about the crazy things he'd endured, about how human beings would be petting him and feeding him sugar cubes 1 minute and then lashing him the next because he couldn't go faster than he was capable of going faster. And one of the themes of that story, and indeed it's one of Leo Tolstoy's favorite themes in his literature, is he says, humans all want to change the world, but none of them are willing to change themselves. And this is something to remember when we talk about trying to return to New Testament Christianity. We always think of it in terms of what's got to change out there, what they should be doing differently, what my church should be doing differently, what that church is doing wrong, what this church is doing wrong. We all want to change the world. And it's not just limited to the church. We want to change the government. We want to change our families. We want to change the place where we work. We all want to change the world. But we don't want to change ourselves. We don't want to get back to that cross. We don't want to stand at the foot of the cross. Because when you're standing at the foot of the cross, all our little arguments look awfully foolish. We don't want to stand at that open tomb. Because if we're standing at that open tomb and trying to deal with the mind-boggling truth of the resurrection, it kind of puts to shame all our preoccupations with football and money and little church politics. It makes it look foolish. But that's what we need to do. If we really want to restore the New Testament church, don't try to change the outward stuff. Let's change our own hearts. Let's exalt the cross and the resurrection back where they belong and let a lot of that other stuff take care of itself. Thanks very much for your patient attention. We'll resume next week.